My featured musical this evening is a 40th anniversary tribute to The Grand Tour, which had music and lyrics by Jerry Herman and a book by Michael Stewart and Mark Bramble, based upon the original play Jakubowski and the Colonel by Franz Werfel in its American adaptation by S.N. Berman. The Grand Tour opened at the Palace Theatre on January 11, 1979, where it ran for a mere 61 performances. And tonight we shall be listening to the original 1979 Broadway cast recording. But to introduce the musical, it's my very great pleasure to welcome via telephone from New York one of the original cast members of the Grand Tour, Kenneth Cantor. Hello, Kenneth.
Hello, how are you? I'm very pleased that people are interested in the Grand Tour.
I'm doing very well indeed. Well, not only is it the 40th anniversary of the Grand Tour, but also the 40th anniversary of your Broadway debut, as this was your first show in New York on the Great White Way.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, I remember on opening night, I was sent a singing telegram that was delivered by a then unknown Nathan Lane.
Oh, extraordinary. The things yeah. People do before they become famous.
Exactly.
Well, to begin at the very beginning, where did your interest in musical theatre come from? Had you done any high school or college shows before?
Yes, I had worked in high school and in college. Mm-hmm. I'd majored in theatre arts. And I'd been auditioning for a number of things. I'd done the national tour of Shenandoah just before I auditioned for the Grand Tour.
Ah, right. Still with John Cullum in the lead role?
No, this was the tour with John Raitt.
Oh, okay. The famous Broadway singer of Carousel, The Pajama Game, and other Broadway shows.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So how did you hear about the Grand Tour and decided that you'd try your luck at auditioning for the show?
Well, there was a casting notice in the newspaper, and I went to audition. As I recall, I was number 255. They were looking for four men, and I was lucky enough to get cast. But prior to my doing it, of course, they were working on the show. It's kind of interesting that there were a number of preliminary titles that they went through on the Grand Tour before it became the Grand Tour. They were talking about calling it On the Road, Hello Tomorrow, Surviving the Fifth Migration of Polka from Paris, and Duel. They had also gone through casting the show long before the ensemble was put together, and some very interesting people auditioned for the show and didn't get it. Gene Wilder auditioned and read and was rejected. Alan Bates was too busy. He was doing The Rose. But Jim Dale auditioned, George Rose, Richard Dreyfuss, Ron Moody. Joel Grey was somewhat down on the list.
Okay.
And then for the Colonel, they auditioned John Raitt, among other people. The most interesting thing that happened regarding the casting of the show was they got a message back from Nicole Williamson, who said, quote, "I'm not interested in a musical and not one where I wasn't the star."
Yes, of course, it appeared in the ill-fated Rex a few seasons earlier. Yes. Richard Rogers' Sheldon Harnick musical version of Henry VIII.
Well, the cast first got together, once we were all cast in the show, at Jerry Herman's penthouse apartment. And it was a very exciting night because they performed the backers audition for us. And so we got to hear all of the songs sung the way they were sung for the people who were trying to put the money together on the show.
Yes.
Once we got into rehearsal, we rehearsed at the Michael Bennett Studios. That's what they were called at that time. They had just finished rehearsing Ballroom, which was going to open on Broadway.
Okay.
And there were still a number of props hanging around the rehearsal hall from that show. And while we were in rehearsal, I don't think we were more than a week into rehearsal, we went away from lunch, came back, there was a change in choreographers, and several dancers were let go from the show. And from that point on, people were very nervous at rehearsal. Originally, it was going to be Mark Bro, the guy who choreographed the movie of Mary Poppins, among other things.
Oh, okay.
And he dropped out, and we got Donald Sadler.
And I suppose most choreographers have their favorite dancers, so...
That's exactly what happened.
Indeed.
That's exactly it. We went through a great deal in rehearsing the show. there's a number in the show called We're Almost There. It takes place on a train.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the joke of it all is that the entire cast was crammed into one car of the train while we were singing it. And we rehearsed it for about 3 days, which is an awfully long time to rehearse one number.
Indeed.
And someone mentioned, I think we're moving the seats in the train in order to accommodate your staging. They taped the seats down, uh-huh. and sure enough, they had to start all over again and restage it.
Oh, dear.
Then when we got on the set, when we were out of town, all of the seats, of course, were in a completely different position. They had to restage it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we were in San Francisco, they brought in Tommy Toon to work on the show,
okay.
to work on some of the staging.
Yes.
And Tommy wanted to completely redo that number.
Oh.
So we spent most of our time rehearsing that one song. Uh-huh. It was quite a lot of work.
Yes, yes, I imagine it would be. And you'll have to help me with these Polish pronunciations. At least I've got Jakubowski, but can you tell me what the colonel's
Bradford.
Full name is and his aide?
Tadeusz Strzebinski
uh-huh.
was the colonel, and his aide was Szabuniewicz.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of trouble with dialect. They added a role for me in the show, Hugo the Hungarian Hercules.
Yes.
And the day they delivered the lines to me that I was going to have to say, they handed them to me. They wanted them to go in that night. And they were all in Hungarian,
which
is a language I do not speak. And they wanted to go in that night. It was quite nerve-wracking learning that so quickly.
Uh-huh. I suppose you had to track down a dialogue coach or somebody who could actually speak Hungarian to...
Yes, there was a woman in San Francisco that they put me onto.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the phone and she was giving me all of the pronunciations. It was very difficult to learn.
Uh-huh.
But while we were out of town, there were a number of songs that were cut from the show.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was a beautiful ballad called Having Someone There that Marianne sang that they cut.
Mm-hmm.
There was a song at the beginning of the show that took place in a laundry during an air raid. And it was a song called Two Possibilities, which is, of course, one of the themes of the Jakubowski character. He always is optimistic because there are always two possibilities to everything that happens in life.
Mm-hmm.
And we rehearsed that song over and over again, and they just couldn't get it to work. And so that one went.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a beautiful song at the beginning of Act Two called What I Am With You, or Tall. I'm not sure what title was actually put into the program. And that lasted for a little while, but they replaced it. It was a ballad, and it was a beautiful ballad.
Yes.
And they replaced it with a song that was a little bit more comic, which is in the show, Mrs. S.L. Jakubowski.
Uh-huh.
And there was one song in the show, though, that created quite a stir. In the second act, while the characters are escaping from the Nazis, they find refuge in a convent. And we had a full stage set for the convent and nuns. Wait, I'm telling the story totally backwards. Let me start again.
Certainly.
The scene took place in a brothel.
Oh, okay. A bit of a change.
And in the brothel, they had these women of the night in very, very revealing negligees
uh-huh.
that were hand-beaded. They were gorgeous costumes.
Mm-hmm.
And the set had a purple player piano upstage and lithographs on the stage of women in very provocative positions.
Yes.
And just above the player piano was an enormous portrait of a Madonna and child. And we played this through previews.
Yes.
And there was a wonderful song in it called I Want to Live Each Night.
Uh-huh.
And while we were in previews, they decided that they didn't like the setting. So one day we arrived back for rehearsal, and up on ladders was Ming Cho Lee, who designed the set.
Yes.
And several of his assistants. And they were completely repainting the set. The piano, the player piano, became a church organ. The lithographs that were on the wall, they were painting heavy veils over. And the portrait that was upstage, that was a picture of the rape of the Sabine women, became a portrait of a Madonna and child. And all of the whores lost their beautiful negligees.
Uh-huh.
And they rented some costumes from a local group that had just done Sound of Music.
Okay.
And bingo, the whores had become nuns.
Quite a transformation.
The interesting thing about that song, I Want to Live Each Night, mm-hmm. is that Jerry put it in intact on the recording of Miss Spectacular.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And it's sung on there by the woman who sang it in our show, Florence Lacey.
Ah, great.
But the number, of course, was cut along with the location of the scene. It was quite a comic thing to watch that.
It did, yes.
And then, of course, when we opened in New York, the reviews became rather mixed.
Mm-hmm.
We had some really terrific reviews. And we had some reviews that were not at all terrific.
Yes.
And we just didn't know which way the show was going to go. And we hung on and hung on, hoping that the audiences would find us. And there was at least one occasion that I can recall that they put the closing notice up on the bulletin board saying that the show was going to close in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at the end of one performance, Joel Grey, who wound up playing Jakubowski, came out on stage with the closing notice and ripped it up, saying that we were going to press on. It was very dramatic, mm-hmm. but unfortunately it wasn't a final solution to the show, and I'm afraid we closed. But once we had closed, we went out again on a national tour that mm-hmm. was booked that they thought would work with Joel Grey's name on it.
Yes, yes.
So we went to Chicago, opened it in Chicago, and I'm afraid we arrived in the middle of one of the worst blizzards that Chicago had ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the audiences, in spite of the fact that they ran a commercial for our show, a very well-produced commercial, the audiences simply didn't find us.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid we closed in Chicago. And on closing night, a telegram was delivered backstage. They put it up on the bulletin board. And it was from Jerry Herman.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, "God knows we tried."
Indeed.
It was a very, very sad closing.
Indeed, yes. Very heartbreaking for somebody making their Broadway debut and thinking that it might lead on to other things.
It actually did eventually. Mm-hmm. The musical director of our show was Wally Harper.
Yes.
And Wally, 2 years later, found himself as the musical supervisor and conductor of a revival on Broadway of Brigadoon.
Mm-hmm.
And he remembered me from the Grand Tour and put me into that show, and I got billing. It was quite lovely. And it was a really beautiful production of the show.
Oh.
And in show business, at least that I've found, if you have two Broadway credits behind you, getting the third one is a lot easier, and everything follows pretty much after that with greater ease. So it was getting those first two shows that was the real trick.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that wouldn't have happened if the door hadn't been opened with Grand Tour.
Ah, great. So it was a stepping stone onto bigger things for you. Do you have any personal
Absolutely.
Do you have any personal ideas why the show failed? Or do you think it might have been the source material, given that it was done as a straight play in 1944 and then, of course, the Danny Kaye film version in 1958?
Well, I've often thought about it. And Jerry wrote wonderful songs for the show. There are some beautiful, beautiful songs. Very entertaining, very uplifting, very positive, the kind of things that Jerry would write. Certainly the ballad Marianne is probably one of Broadway's prettiest ballads. I know it was in Barbara Cook's repertoire for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, was that you couldn't get away from the central story of the show, that the two characters in the show were running away from people who wanted to murder them.
Yes.
And the book, I'm afraid, eventually became a bit of a downer and was probably at odds with the musical numbers, which tried to promise the audience a certain amount of entertainment. And I think it was the dichotomy between the book telling a rather serious story. I mean, Jakubowski at the end of the show is abandoned. And we don't know what's going to happen to him at the end of the show. He sings something very optimistic, and we get the feeling that he's probably going to survive because he's survived so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But nevertheless, he's left there. And the story, I think, was just a bit of a downer. And Jerry tried so hard to breathe life into it. But I think the problem was the basic material I don't think would work really very much as the kind of musical that Jerry wanted to write.
Yes.
I remember one rehearsal. I would get there quite early and stay well past when everybody was dismissed because it was my first Broadway show and I was very interested. And I remember one session at the Current Theater where we were trying out in San Francisco, where Michael Stewart really sort of lost his temper. He was rather volatile, a sweet guy. I loved him.
Yeah.
And we got on beautifully. But he lost his temper and basically turned to everybody who was in the production meeting and said, listen, I look at the show at night and it's not the show that I wrote. I don't care anymore. What do you want me to write? And I'll just write it.
Hmm. Yeah.
And so I think if you wanted to put a finger on why the show didn't work, I think you'd have to point at the book. Because the score, which was at odds with the book,
yes,
was still a very entertaining score and quite a beautiful score.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Certainly when we recorded the album, we recorded it at the old Columbia Studios, where all of the great cast albums were recorded. South Pacific was recorded there. And all of the major Columbia recordings of cast albums were all recorded there. And listening to the score in the recording, when we finally got copies of it, was really quite thrilling. And certainly making the recording, I don't think Columbia was too excited about making it, but on the strength of Jerry Herman's reputation, and because the show had run past a certain number of performances, they were contractually obligated to record it.
Yes.
And then Jerry put some pressure on them to issue the recording.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how it came out.
I see.
And it's a wonderful, I mean, having done the show, and having been in the room while we were recording it, it really is a wonderful souvenir of the experience.
As we shall hear later this evening, too. I guess its failure was a big disappointment, too, to Jerry, not only because it only ran 61 performances, but because his previous two musicals, Mac and Mabel and Dear World, were equally unsuccessful. Only ran.
He had gone through a very, very dark period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was greatly discouraged. And I think he truly believed, he also incidentally wrote a few songs for Day in Hollywood, Night in the Ukraine,
mm-hmm,
during that period. And as a matter of fact, one of the songs is sort of, part of the melody is borrowed from something that was in Grand Tour.
Okay.
But I think he sort of felt that Broadway had passed him by. And Jerry, in addition to writing music, was an architecture major in college, and he renovates homes.
Okay.
And I think he sort of moved backwards and did that for a while, which he found very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he got the opportunity to do Caja Foll, suddenly he was back at the top of his game again.
Yes, yes.
And rather than risk the vicissitudes of working on Broadway and whether his next show would be a success or whatever, I think he felt that he wanted to leave on a high note. And yeah, with Kaj, he certainly did. He won, I believe it won Best Musical that year.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite proud of that show. And I think after that, he figured that this would be a good time to step away.
Yes.
And sad to say, he hasn't written since Kaj. But Grand Tour was right in the middle of that very dark period. But certainly, if you listen to Mac and Mabel, which has a glorious score,
indeed,
or Dear World, which I saw a number of times, this was before I worked with him,
mm-hmm,
I saw it a number of times, and there are some beautiful songs in that.
Indeed.
And I remember actually in rehearsal, sometimes he would sit down to the piano when we had a break, and would just play through a couple of them, which I found very exciting.
Yes, yes. Well, I've had the pleasure of performing in a local amateur production of Mac and Mabel, so I sort of know the show from the inside, playing the role of Mr. Fox. But there again, that was let down by its book, of course, because it couldn't change the fact that Mabel Norman dies at the end.
Yes, it's very much the problem, I think, with Grand Tour is very similar to the problem with Mac and Mabel. The songs are beautiful. The songs are uplifting. The songs are positive. I recall Jerry once saying that he felt that Mac and Mabel was about a bunch of kids that made good in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you still had that very depressing story. And I don't think there was any way that the two shows that were existing on that stage, the positive, uplifting, exciting musical comedy score and the dark, dark show that the script that was provided, because, I mean, it's a biographical story, and you can't really change the facts too much, were at war with each other, very much as what happened with Grand Tour.
Mm-hmm.
I think if he was failed in any way, I think he was always failed in the scripts not being up to his work.
Indeed, yes. And I suppose it's unfortunate that its failure, I guess, led to the fact that there's only really three Gerry Herman musicals that are revived these days. Hello, Dolly, of course, which has played on Broadway recently, Mame, and also La Cage aux Folles.
Yeah.
Milk and Honey, his early success, isn't revived so often.
It's a pretty score, but I don't think the show really holds up. But I did the last Broadway production of Mame with Angela Lansbury.
Oh.
And it was nice being reunited with Gerry again. But again, we were in a flawed production. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid it was not as successful as it really should have been. Of all of the shows that I've done on Broadway, that's the one I think that was the most heartbreaking. Because mm-hmm. it was a good production. And we had just about everybody in the original cast, with the exception of Bea Arthur. We had everyone from the original cast in the show, mm-hmm. and they played it with such authority and such clarity. These were people who really knew their parts and played them brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, again, didn't work, but that opened right when Cage was happening. And I think Gerry was hoping that Cage might pull Mame along. Sad to say, it didn't. We were all horribly disappointed with that one.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Do you know if there have been any revivals of the Grand Tour, even just amateur circuit or regional American revivals?
Actually, there have been.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine wound up playing Hugo the Hungarian Hercules.
Oh, okay.
And it was a little off-Broadway production that they did at the Jewish Rep Company.
Uh-huh.
And when my friend got cast in the part, he called me and said, "How do I pronounce these words?" And because it had taken so long for me to learn them properly to begin with, of course, I was able to give him the pronunciations exactly. So, yeah, there have been productions of it. And I believe Gerry did another production of it on the West Coast, which was fairly successful.
Yes.
Again, in a very, very small venue. And I believe that's it, though. You know, once a show has failed on Broadway, it's very difficult to try to get it redone. And so I think Gerry has satisfied himself with the few revivals that of Grand Tour that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun to see the show, because certainly when I was in it, I never really got a chance to see it.
Yes.
But it was a disappointment in a way, it being my first Broadway show. It would have been wonderful if it were a hit.
Mm-hmm.
But by the same token, I learned a great deal from doing it. And that was a very good thing. And it certainly builds your spine when you're in a show like that.
Mm-hmm.
And made a lot of friends in the original production of it that I worked with subsequently and met subsequently and spent time with subsequently. And they were lovely, lovely people. Jean Verone, who was in the original quintet in A Little Night Music,
yes,
was in Grand Tour.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a font of wonderful theater stories. He was a very dear man.
Ah, great. And how do you rate the Grand Tour amongst the Broadway musicals that you've appeared in? I'm looking at the Internet Broadway database, and it lists Brigadoon, mm-hmm. Mame, Me and My Girl, Phantom of the Opera, Guys and Dolls, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Yes, actually, it's interesting. And A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, I wound up understudying Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, quite unique.
Yes, it's a real oddity of my career.
Indeed.
But for a while there, I was working with Jerry Zaks quite a lot, who was the director of Guys and Dolls and of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
Yes.
And I also did the tour of the Lincoln Center production of Anything Goes that he directed.
Ah, great.
So, you know, one show really sort of leads to the next, which leads to the next. And you can't get too disappointed, because you never know what doors are going to open. I auditioned for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang,
mm-hmm.
and wound up getting cast in Phantom of the Opera because the people who were doing the show overlapped.
Yes.
So they put me into Phantom of the Opera until Chitty opened.
Yes.
Then I went into Chitty, did that for a year, and then went back to Phantom of the Opera again.
Ah.
So it's an odd business that way.
Indeed. And of course, The Phantom of the Opera is Broadway's longest running musical, and you're currently appearing in it still. How is it with such a long run that you're able to keep the show fresh, well, both for the audience and for yourself?
I find it a fascinating challenge. First of all, no two performances are alike, because no two audiences are alike.
Yes.
Then on top of that, in Phantom of the Opera, we have a lot of people who come and go. We have illnesses, and so people are out. And you look around the stage to find the inspiration of the first time. And very often circumstances give you that opportunity.
Yes.
And it's a challenge. There's no question of it. It's a challenge to do. I think I've done about 5,000 performances of the show. I take very few vacations and take very few sick days. And I find that challenge kind of exciting in a bizarre sort of way, because you are doing the same show. You can't change the lines. You can't change the blocking. You can't change any of that. But you can continue to explore the part. And if you're creative enough, it's very difficult to become terribly bored doing your part.
Yes, yes. I remember anecdotes about, well, the Australian soprano June Bronhill, who appeared in the original production of The Sound of Music out here in Australia, in Melbourne, in fact. She played Maria von Trapp in 1961. And she said that you get to a stage where you're almost on autopilot. She realised that once, when she was singing My Favourite Things on stage, that she was also planning what she was going to have for lunch on Sunday. And that sort of pulled her up, and she thought, oh, gosh, I better put a bit more concentration into what I'm doing.
Because when... when that happens to you, that's when your mind can wander, and that's when you can get into horrible, horrible trouble on stage. And keeping that concentration is very difficult. But in that, the larger your role is, the easier it actually is. It's the small roles that are very, very challenging, because you don't have that much material to explore.
Yes.
And that becomes a real challenge in a long run. But we had, I don't know if you're aware of George Lee Andrews. George Lee Andrews is in the Guinness Book of Records for the longest continual performance in a show. He was cast in Phantom of the Opera in the original cast, and he stayed with it, oh, good Lord, easily 25 years. And every performance that he gave was fresh and alive and exciting. He was a master at a long run.
Yes.
And when he was in the show, he provided a yardstick to measure your work by. Because if he could be doing it for 25 years and still be so excited at doing the show, it creates a bar that you have to pass.
Indeed, yes. I recall reading an interview with him at the time, him saying, you know, weighing up the options between the security of a long run in something like Phantom of the Opera or the insecurity of auditioning for new shows. And apparently he had a couple of children, and he thought, well, he could put them through college, et cetera, et cetera, and pay for all the living expenses by staying in the Phantom of the Opera.
It's true. But, you know, for him... there are a number of people in our show that, are in that position,
yes,
where they have family and so on. And so, you know, the staying in the show provides them with a financial anchor that makes a normal life possible. But with George, in addition to that, he really brought such artistry to what he was doing, and such freshness and such excitement at being on stage, that it was more than just a job for George. He was truly an inspiration to the cast.
Ah, great. And do you have any ideas when Phantom of the Opera might finally face its final curtain? Or
you know, I don't think it will.
Ah.
I have a feeling that the show is going to outlive a great many of us. they have, obviously, a cushion, a financial cushion, because the show has run so long and has been so enormously successful, that when they hit the doldrums, which we're right in the middle of now, January slows down at our theater, nobody panics, nobody worries, because they know that February is coming and the summer is coming and holidays are coming. And there are times, I mean, every show closes, but there are times when I look at it and I go, I don't think this thing is ever going to close. It's enormously successful, enormously popular with the audiences. And as long as people continue to come, the only thing that I think might conceivably close it, I mean, there are two things that could conceivably close Phantom of the Opera. One of them is if tourists stop coming to New York for any particular reason. They came close to closing on September 11th.
Yes.
And it was very touch and go at that point. That's as close as the show's come to closing. But in addition to that, I mean, this is a crazy thing to talk about, but the set could wear out, technically.
Yes, yes.
I mean, no scenery, however well built it is, Mm-hmm. No scenery is really designed to run for this many years. And from what I understand, technically, the show has become very difficult to maintain.
Okay.
Because a lot of the motorized equipment and things like that, they just don't make anymore.
Oh.
And so how do you upkeep it? How do you keep it moving? Mm-hmm. How do you keep it so that, you know, the show just doesn't collapse technically?
Yes, yes.
So from what I understand, those are the two Achilles heels with regard to Phantom. It's certainly not audience popularity.
Oh, okay.
And so as long as tourists continue to come to New York, and as long as they can continue to maintain the physical production, mm-hmm. the show is going to run.
Indeed, yes. Although I suppose similar to Les Miserables, they remounted the production and had a different setting with video effects, etc. I suppose they might even update the Phantom of the Opera in a similar style.
Well, they've done that on a tour that's gone out. But I don't think that that would be a wise decision for Broadway. I think when people come to see it on Broadway, they want to see the thing, whatever that, you know, whatever the thing Phantom of the Opera is.
Yes.
In order to do that, just from a technical point of view, in order to do that, they would have to close the show for a certain period of time, and they would lose their momentum, and I don't think they would do it. Mm-hmm. I think the show on Broadway is going to stay, from an audience's point of view, looking at the show is going to stay looking exactly the way it looks now. The design of the show is amazing.
Yes.
Maria Bjornson, who designed the set and the costumes, did a spectacular job, and the audiences are so satisfied with what they see, and they contribute so strongly to Hal Prince's marvelous direction of the show, that, again, I don't think they would ever redo the show. I think it's going to stay exactly the way it is, as long as they can as long as they can keep it running, you know, technically, and as long as there's audience around to see it.
Ah, great. Well, we wish you continued success in the Phantom of the Opera and also in the rest of your career. And are there any dream roles that you still would like to play?
You know, it's a crazy thing, but I've had a very, very fortunate career. And what with tours and summer theaters and regional theaters, I've played just about every role that I've ever really wanted to play.
Mm-hmm.
There's still one that I would love to do. I would love to play J.B. Bigley in How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Ah, great.
But other than that, I've had a very, very satisfactory career. I've got no regrets, no complaints.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you very much, Kenneth, for coming online to introduce tonight's broadcast of The Grand Tour, and we shall be listening to you at least in the ensemble numbers in the original 1979 Broadway cast recording.
Well, I should tell you, you can hear my voice in one particular place.
Uh-huh.
In one extraordinary thing, there is a choral part that starts with a bass going oompa oompa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the oompa oompa.
Ah, right. We'll keep our ears attuned to that oompa oompa when it comes along then.
Very good.
Great. And I'd like to thank my special guest, Kenneth Cantor, for coming online to give us his personal background to The Grand Tour. Thank you very much, Kenneth, and goodbye for now.
Take care. Bye-bye.